Felicitations, greetings, and welcome to the Evil Empire Podcast. Yes, due to the malfunction of a displacement-activated spore hub drive, you have been transported to a dark mirror universe and a parallel version of Earth, one in which I, James Dyer, and not Chris Hewitt, host the Empire Podcast, having long since murdered, dismembered, and disposed of him and assumed the crown. It is a reality so twisted that a mad racist despot has taken over the United States, where tweets stretch to an unspeakable 280 characters, and where The Boss Baby is apparently a film worthy of Oscar nomination. It is a lot like Biff Tannen's Hill Valley, I'm saying, only far, far more terrifying. But on the Evil Empire Podcast this week, we will be chatting Death Cure with Maze Runner star Dylan O'Brien, swapping evil plasticine techniques with Nick Park and paying tribute to the dark god of mischief himself, one of Empire's greatest villains, but something we'll get onto later, and the vocal star of First Man, Mr. Tom Hiddleston. Joining me in the bad place this week are two colleagues of nefarious wickedness, whose very names strike fear into the hearts of godly folk. First up is Our Lady of Blessed Murder, Bane of Bond, Ruin of Hamilton haters, and scourge of the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. She puts the ick in film critic. It's hell, an O'Hara. Hello, Helen.
What is happening? So many different references there.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm doing well.
Did you know that Chris, were he in fact alive and not murdered, would be going to see Hamilton this evening?
I did know that, yes.
Yeah, that's quite a thing.
That is an excellent thing. He can finally understand what all of the fuss is about.
Yeah, next week's going to be a good one for you too, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Next up, we have a man who can't be bargained with, who can't be reasoned with, who doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, a man who absolutely will not stop ever until you agree with his one-star review of Taken. It's Dastardly Dan Jolin.
Hello, yeah,
Hello, Dan.
I think I've come to the wrong meeting. My quantum signature, I think if you check it, I'm not really supposed to be in this universe.
Hot Star Trek Discovery reference right there.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been watching it? Have you seen the new one?
Oh, it's awesome.
Isn't it?
It's so good.
It just keeps being good and then carries on being good and then gets good again.
I know!
But I made the mistake of starting to watch it with my kids, thinking, yeah, Star Trek, it'll be fine for
them. Sexy and tortury.
And then, yeah, when the whole Klingon sort of thought it was Klingon rape, but it actually wasn't Klingon rape stuff happened. My 8-year-old was a bit like, yeah, you better leave the room, I think.
Yeah. I think that's fair. It's very good, though. I'm really, really, really enjoying it.
Yeah. I also love this show because its title is a compound of two Pet Shop Boys albums.
I think that's what they had in mind. Mm. I believe that's the premise for the whole show.
Sure. I was actually disappointed that the running tops that they were wearing in one episode, which you can actually buy, they say disco on the front, but they don't say very on the back, which I think is a massive, massive missed opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. One of them should have said disco and the one next to it should have said very.
Oh, my goodness. But then you'd always have to run with that partner. It would be difficult.
It would limit your options, I think. Mm. Yeah. I'd be watching Strike this week. Did you ever watch Strike?
Mm. Oh, yes, I did.
Yes, it's very, very good. It's Tom Burke and Holiday Granger. It's based on the J.K. Rowling detective novels, and I missed it when it first was on, but I've been enjoying that a lot. Lots of fun.
Okay,
so you know,
I will check it out, James.
Good.
Thanks for the recommendation.
Right, that's enough foreplay. Let's get on to the main event, which begins as ever with a question from you, dear listeners. This time from @River Saeed, who asks, "I remember being shocked that 'sounds like a $2 hooker' was said in Disney's Cool Runnings. What children's movies would you not let a child watch?" What do we think?
Ooh, I don't know. I genuinely don't have so much of a problem with bad language and stuff for kids because they have guaranteed heard worse.
Yeah.
Like any child in the world raised, you know, in the middle of a field, in the middle of nowhere, has still heard more swearing than you will hear in most PG films. So I'm kind of okay with that. I think the one I'd be wary of is actually probably violence. And the violence that I'm particularly wary of is the kind that is dishonest. So I know I've talked about this on the podcast before, but, you know, Home Alone is incredibly violent. That is a violent film that kids could actually take some stuff from and try themselves with disastrous consequences. That is, in many ways, far more dangerous than, you know, anything else. And films that kind of lie about their violence or just have incredibly violent scenes but take out the blood so they can get away with a PG rating, I think are problematic.
Yeah, murder has consequences, kids.
Learn it, yeah.
No, I'm with you. Like Transformers in particular, because obviously it's based on toys. It's something that, you know, people associate with toys, and yet incredibly violent, and has, well, the sequel at least, has giant swinging robot bollocks in it, which can't be good.
Also a bit sexist.
It's really leery, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you first see Megan Fox in it, she's like bent over a car, and it's all a bit like, really?
But then he made it for teenage boys, didn't he?
Well, he in many ways is a teenage boy. But
More of which later on The Death Cure. But,
yes, indeed.
I have problems with things that are kind of dishonest. Like, so, for example, something like Mac and Me, which was basically a McDonald's advert in the form of a movie, which, you know, it's a fun kids thing. It's just like there's something horrible happening under the surface with something like that. So that kind of stuff bothers me.
On that basis, my dad objected to My Little Pony and Care Bears, which, you know, at a time in my life, I was very into.
So, I cannot imagine this time.
Oh, it was big. I had like books full of stickers and drawings and everything.
I saw Care Bears 1 and 2 at the cinema.
Me too.
Wow.
Yeah. So the point being, like, I would have been, you know, just devastated if I wasn't allowed to see those for some reason.
But that's different, though. I mean, they are products, but they are created for, you know, enjoyment, entertainment, for the stimulation of imagination and all that business. Whereas, you know, Mac and Me was just selling filthy, greasy burgers made from minced up animals.
At a time when you were a vegetarian.
Possibly.
I sense the distress in your voice.
Care Bears are actually about brainwashing. That Care Bear stare, that brainwashes people. Yeah. It's really creepy.
Have you seen, like, I can tell you were a Twilight Sparkle kind of girl, Helen, My Little Pony. But have you seen, like, Equestria Girls? Which is like, it's like...
What?
Yeah, so the ponies go through a portal to Equestria. You see what they did there? And it's like, it's basically then becomes a high school drama where the ponies have become girls. They're sort of transmogrified into humanoids so that they can have teenage adventures at a posh boarding school.
I just want to point out, because you've given the big evil introduction and you've established your evil credentials, and now you're talking about My Little Pony.
Yes.
With knowledge, James, knowledge.
I see what you're saying, but you see, Twilight Sparkle has an evil alternate ego called Midnight Sparkle.
No.
And she is my spirit animal.
But again, your spirit animal is still My Little Pony.
Let's move on.
Wait, I've got a fun fact. Can I do a fun fact?
Yes.
There is a tabletop My Little Pony role-playing game, RPG, Dungeons & Dragons style, which came out last year, I think it was. So there you go. If you want to, you know, be a pony...
Or a brony.
Yeah, if you want to be Midnight Sparkle, you could be Midnight Sparkle, James.
Oh, that's tantalising.
Yeah.
this is so disturbing.
Yeah, moving on. I'm gonna throw out Big as my ick factor film. Partly because it is a PG film which has fuck, some goddamns, an arsehole, a bastard in it. Oof. So it's quite heavy on the language. And there's also a, air quotes, sleepover.
Yeah.
And some breast groping, and it all goes horribly U-tree. And it's really upsetting when you actually watch it.
But I think that's one of those things that's a bit more upsetting for adults who have knowledge of what's going on than kids who have no real concept. Which kind of makes it better in a way.
Like,
and this is a different thing, but Coraline, for example, every adult I know is like, oh my God, that's far too scary. I don't understand how anyone can watch that. And kids are all like, yay!
Oh,
buttons for eyes!
No, most kids I know
not
have
in
been,
my house.
Well, I mean, Dan.
No, that film, that was harrowing for them. Mm. I mean, I laughed, but it was harrowing for them.
Wow.
You see, well, that might be because you laughed. Like, because everybody else I know, the parents were terrified and the kids loved it.
Was it an evil belly laugh?
Yeah, and also it wasn't helped by the fact that I burst into my kid's bedroom wearing a pair of buttons over my eyes and knives on the ends of my hands.
That'll do it. You went a full Nightbreed on them. That's terrifying. You know Maya the Bee? Do you know Maya the Bee is a Netflix cartoon?
I have no idea.
And there was a big fury last year because there's a freeze frame where someone's drawn a giant cock and balls on a rock, which goes past quite quickly, but if you slow it down, you can see it in there. And that caused it to be pulled. There was a big Daily Mail outcry about that.
So someone pulled the cock.
Someone pulled the cock and the balls off of Netflix.
You're both terrible.
Yeah.
This is like the urban legend about Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
When
they have the car crash, you know, in the taxi,
yeah.
and Jessica Rabbit falls out of the car, apparently her skirt flies up and you can see, you know.
She's not wearing any pants.
She's not.
I freeze-framed that.
Commando Jessica.
So many times.
I mean, but apparently it is an urban legend because even Dan couldn't find it after extensive search.
Is this like the Aladdin one? You know the Aladdin one? Where when he's, as Prince Ali, trying to woo Princess Jasmine, he goes up and the tiger, Raja, starts harassing him. And he says to it, he sort of like mumbles, "Good teenagers, take off your clothes." And everyone was like, "Ooh," but... And
no,
you listen
doesn't.
To it. No, but that's what it sounds like. Apparently, it's something like "Good kitty, take off and go" or something. But it sounds a little bit risque. And isn't there also in, I want to say, The Lion King, there's a bit where there's a bit of dust goes up. And if you slow it down just right, it spells out sex.
That's the clouds in the sky.
Is it the clouds?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that's a thing that
which,
probably isn't a thing
which
as
they,
well.
They look a bit like they might say sex, but I don't think it's an intentional
yeah.
thing.
This is just a Rorschach test, isn't it, for cinema-going audiences? You project your own shit onto this
stuff. I think that's what's happening yeah. for the most part, yeah.
E.T., I wouldn't show a child to, because I think the shed scene in E.T. is poltergeist-level scary. Like, when the ball comes out, that, I just shat my pants as a child with that. I could not watch it.
I did see that when I was little. I don't know. It was in the cinema. So I would be okay with that. It does have scary moments, for sure.
Mm.
For sure. And it will destroy you. But I think kids have to get used to being destroyed by films, emotionally
fine.
Speaking, obviously not physically.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang as well, Child Catcher.
That's
not good. Oof. But then equally, like, all the parental stuff, you know, like Bambi, you know, all of the death of parents. There's a lot of that in there. The beginning of Finding Nemo. I mean, that's traumatic.
Yeah, I'm still not over that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of... But basically, don't ever let your kids see films. Is probably
that's really not the message
the moral,
that we
yeah.
as Empire want to be sending out here.
Censorship, Helen. We can all agree censorship is a good thing.
Except Alien. That's great for kids.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah. What? No.
Yeah? Any more for any more?
That's all we got.
No?
Thomas and the Magic Railroad, because it's shit.
Okay, I'll take from Dan.
I mean, that's true of a lot of kids' stuff, so...
Oh, well, but Thomas and the Magic Railroad is especially weirdly shit.
Okay. Also the Emoji Movie, because that's basically child abuse.
Oh, so. No one should see
no
that.
No one should eat that. As ever, if you want a chance to hear us attempt to answer a simple question in as convoluted a fashion as possible, do tweet us using the hashtag Empire Podcast or email us at podcast@empiremagazine.com. We are also on Facebook under the top secret pseudonym Empire Magazine. Right, that's out of the way. Shall we have a first interview?
Sure.
He is the star of The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, and now the final installment in The Maze Runner trilogy, The Death Cure. He's the boy who cried wolf, because he's...
In Teen Wolf.
Teen Wolf, yeah. He's Dylan O'Brien, and Chris Hewitt braved both mazes and running to bring you the following interview.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of Maze Runner, The Death Cure, Dylan O'Brien. How are you, sir?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. How's London treating you so far?
London's always good. I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I used to have a theory, too, where I'd... every time I come to London, I felt like the weather was beautiful. So I would, an ongoing joke about how the locals here are always talking about the crappy weather just to hide the fact that it's actually amazing weather.
Yeah, it's always amazing.
This was the first time that I actually flew in and it was terrible out.
Oh, really?
Like, I guess it is true.
Did you come in yesterday then when there was snow in the ground, there was all sorts of stuff happening yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday.
It was like geostorm.
Yeah. It was snowing when we landed.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Okay. And
none of it was not sticking, though. It doesn't stick.
No, it didn't stick.
No.
It didn't stick. It hasn't stuck in London for about, I'd say, 5-6 years.
Yeah?
Which sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
I like
it does.
Snow.
I know. It's funny because I always thought of London as like a cold, damp place, you know, that would get routine snows, but I guess not so much.
Have you been suckered by the old depictions of London as, you know, foggy, real pea soupers? You ever see those in the old Sherlock Holmes stories?
No.
There's so much fog you can't see anything. And there's never any fog.
I've never seen
never
fog here.
Yeah.
No. Unless you're coming through the clouds when you're landing, but that's all.
Yeah, the most we can do.
It's very high up fog.
The most we have, an occasional mist, some smog, but it's all good. What do you do when you're in London? Do you have time to sightsee?
Yeah, I've got little places that I go and see. Yeah, I go see the Queen, you know, it's good to check in with her.
Yeah, how is she these days? I haven't seen her
in a while. She's amazing, man. She's still on the treadmill every morning.
she's on the treadmill?
Every morning.
The Queen's on the treadmill.
5 a.m.
Yeah, she's 115 years old. She's
unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. I don't know what they feed them.
Poor people.
Yeah, I have... My God,
that's, pretty
that's
much what
essentially
they eat.
It.
That's what they eat.
It's all
Keeps
the whole
looking.
Thing's amazing to me. No, I have little local spots that I go to. You know,
okay.
You know, people in those places too. Like my little local pub I had here when I was here shooting for a while. You know,
okay.
That I'll go back and see, say hey to. And
these are not places you want to name check necessarily.
Oh no, not at all.
In case people suddenly turn up.
Come find me here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not somebody who has a GPS and all
that. No, I got a little chip in my neck, actually. And it broadcasts to fans over Twitter all the time.
All right. Because it's interesting. Because
I don't think we're far away from that, to be honest.
We're not far away from that, are we? And there will be people who will willingly submit to that.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you will not be one of those people.
No. I won't be doing the surgery, no.
It's just a procedure. It's just, you wouldn't even feel it.
People are trying to sell you on it in like a year or two. It's like, it'll really help your career.
Yeah.
Get the chip. Everyone's doing the chip.
You don't want to know if you're going to be, Shake Shack. for half an hour. Anyway.
Well, if they want to know, I will be.
Anyway.
So.
Yeah, that's the new thing. There's an episode of Black Mirror right there.
Where so true.
Where famous people will be.
That's true. We could write that episode.
I might go and do that, actually, if you can just, you know what I'm going to ask.
It'd be good. Yeah, I know, exactly. I'll just stay here and just answer all the routine questions while you draft up a pilot.
What sort of routine questions have you been getting? What's the question you've been asked most?
For this one, it's probably, last movie, you guys have spent 5 years together, how does it feel wrapping it up? That's probably the most. Do you want to reverse it? Do you want to answer that question for me?
How does it feel for
How do you feel about us wrapping up the movie?
I'm excited for the future.
Yeah.
Previously, you always had these movies, and now I look at the IMDb page, and there's nothing. There's like a blank slate.
Right.
There's freedom.
Yeah, right.
To go wherever you will go.
Right.
Or am I you now? I'm confused.
No, I thought, I was going to say, yeah. I thought you were answering as me.
Am I me? Okay,
or just answer as you. It's funnier if you answer as you, but answering the same question. Because you don't have the same
rule.
Yeah.
In the third person.
I guess, yeah.
Oh, Dylan's excited. The future is an open book now.
No, see, I think you should answer as you and just be like, couldn't care less about the movie's ending.
I was excited to see a fourth one. I'm disappointed there won't be a fourth one now.
I know. I don't know. Where do you go? I don't know where to go.
The standard procedure with movies based on novels like this is to do...
Four.
Yeah, do four.
Maximize the profits.
Yeah, do a two-part last part.
Yeah. People don't care about things like this, but we, refused the option to spread it out into four movies because, that's a corporate studio thing that, has sort of derailed the original structure of a trilogy, which is, beginning, middle, end. Just so they can try to split two movies off the end of it and make more money, so people don't even realize that they're getting ripped off. They're just so excited that they get a whole other movie. It was always, I always really respected the decision in The Stand by Wes, really. If there was any talk ever of trying to stretch it out into four, he kind of always combated that. And I always respected that, too, because I agree from a story standpoint, that, you're just, you're tainting the story and stretching out the process just to maximize the profits and just to get another influx of money from, and I just don't believe in that.
It ends as well.
Yeah, it has a conclusion,
Feel like there's a cliffhanger. It doesn't feel, not to give anything away.
No, I know, but I like, again, a concrete ending is becoming rarer and rarer. Everything feels like it can be spun off. Everything feels like it can be stretched out into another... extended version of the trilogy. It becomes four, five, six movies, whatever it is. That's not a trilogy anymore. Let's break down the root of the word trilogy. Three! I've always admired that about our movie, it's your standard version. It's your standard trilogy that's kind of few and far between, I feel like. And it does have a conclusion. It has a resolution and it does end, I think in the climate of today's industries, I don't know, it's just sort of, that becomes harder and harder to do.
No, it's a good thing because, I'm a big fan of what Marvel are doing, but at the same time, I've become very, very resigned to the fact that they will outlive me. And Star Wars will outlive me. Mm-hmm. And, I've hopefully got at least another 10 or 20 years on this planet. You never know.
At least,
that's what I'm hoping. But I've got a suspicion that whenever I'm 80, touch wood.
I was going to say, what are you, 80, 90?
I'm 80 now,
Yeah.
It's like the Queen's 115.
You're 80, I'm 80. You guys are old here, man. What do you eat?
We eat more people. I'm telling you, my health is getting.
You live a long time.
We munch in the working classes. It's what happens here in Britain. But, they're going to outlive me, and those movies are going to carry on forever. And when you sign on to one of those films, you're signing on to, I imagine, the next 10 years of your life.
Yeah, well, Marvel in particular, yeah, and Star Wars, yeah.
Which didn't happen with Maze Runner. That was very much a 3-year commitment. It's going to take 4 or 5 years. We're going to hit them hard. Mm-hmm. Teen Wolf for you as well, I imagine. When you signed on for that, did you know how long it was going to run?
No, you sign on for a certain amount, you know, but I think, you know, Marvel things, Star Wars things, those things are different. They have such a huge built-in fan base, so many people just anticipating those films, you know, that I think those are the decade contracts that I'm hearing about, you know, and things like that. With this, it was different. It was, you know, this wasn't a brand before, you know. Yeah, I mean, it was you know, it did have a fan base as books, you know. But not nearly on the same scale, obviously. And I don't know, it makes the same. And with Teen Wolf, too, I don't think, you know, and none of us could have known ever how long it would last or how far we'd go with the show. And then with these movies, you know, it was the same thing. It's one of the things I'm most proud of about both of those projects, really, to be honest. It's like, you know, the fact that they kind of found their own little place in the world and in this industry. It's hard to picture that when you're actually like, I don't know, starting to act in projects and stuff. You don't ever, because you're in them, it doesn't seem like they're, it's hard to picture them actually becoming a thing in a way, I guess, if that makes sense. I don't know. I think it was never a treacherous contract like that. It was, you know, obviously both things were sort of set out with contracts in place, but also sort of, you know, knock on wood, like, you know, it's the studio or network trying something, and, you know, if you go make it work, then we'll run with it. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to go, I don't want to delve into the accident that befell you on the set of this movie, Dylan, but it does seem to me that has it given you a different philosophical viewpoint, a different philosophical outlook in terms of taking control of your own career and being in charge of your own decisions? And
yeah, I mean, well, you know, it has made me grow up in a lot of ways that, you know, I may have otherwise not. In a weird way, you do when you go through some kind of thing like that. It does teach you things, obviously, you know, so... And in a way, I think that can correlate, you know, I think it does here. I think in a way, yeah, I'd never really, before it happened, I don't know if it's just getting older, if that plays a part, but I think I have in the last year or two since it happened, you know, it's realized that, I guess, yeah, I don't know, I guess it would be something I want to do, to take more control, you know, in my own career. And I think that's something everybody should strive to do at a certain point. You know, there's obviously, again, it's a funny arc, because when you start out acting, you know, you're just trying to get a job, you know, you're walking into these rooms, you're desperate for any kind of thing. You're almost not even like thinking about whether or not you want to do it. There's really no question at first. You're at their mercy, and understandably so, you know, it's all about kind of starting out and trying to get something, and just get something, whatever the hell it is, you know, and then trying to do good work, and then try to build off of that, and try to have that go well enough that then maybe you get another thing, or, you know, you keep, I don't know, working at your auditions or whatever. But you do have a certain point, I think, both as you get older and maybe, you know, with some success, and you're fortunate enough to, I don't know, just, or brave enough to just try to start, you know, operating outside of that circle a little bit. And that's how people craft out these really interesting careers, too, I feel like. Whenever I look at people that I really admire, really respect, and I just feel like there's so many pieces of their career, so many things that I've loved and seen them in that, you know, they got going with their own company or with their friend, you know, whatever it is. I think that's most of I think that's how you're going to find interesting things for yourself. So, yeah, and, you know, and whether or not the accent, I don't know, I think it's interesting. That could definitely correlate, but I think it's just growing up in general, too, and that's just a common progression, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm off to see the Queen.
Tell her I say, you know,
or you
pound it.
Queen. Hang on, you Dylan or my Dylan? I'm very confused about the whole thing, but I will tell the Queen to pound it. Whatever the hell that means.
That's what we do together. We, we fist bump it.
Yeah. All right. It's been a pleasure. Dylan O'Brien. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Thank you. Cheers, man.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That was Dylan O'Brien. Time for some news? Time for some news, I think.
Sure.
What's been happening on the internet?
What's happened this week?
Something I can't quite... oh, yes, that's it. The Oscar nominees. The nominees for the 90th Annual Academy Awards were unveiled this week. Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water took 13 nominations, including Best Film, Best Director, Best Actress for Sally Hawkins, Best Supporting Actor, and Original Screenplay for a film that I didn't like. But apparently I'm the only one, so that's
maybe
great.
Not.
Oh, good. Dunkirk got 8 nominations, including the first Best Director for Christopher Nolan. Martin McDonagh's 3 Billboards got 7. Phantom Thread got 6. I want to say Get Out got a number of them, but including Best Film, Best Director, and... Daniel Kaluuya, which was exciting.
And Daniel, so 4 anyway, for sure.
But none of that matters, Helen. None of that matters.
Good Lord.
Because the 4-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game got its well-deserved nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay.
So I didn't argue with its screenplay, if you remember, James. Yeah. I said its screenplay was good.
La, not listening.
Anyway.
But Greta Gerwig, that's pretty cool.
Greta Gerwig, only the 5th female nominee for Best Director ever. Also, Jordan Peele, the 5th black man. Up for Best Director in the same category. So we are in an unusual position where only 2 of the nominees are lily white men, which is, I think, a first. That is extremely interesting. I mean, it was a broad sweep and it felt like a better awards than maybe previous years. You know, I know that Shape of Water had 13 and our traditional, you know, analysis was always the person with the most nominations is generally the front runner. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think a lot of those are below the line. I think I'm not saying it'll be a sort of a Color Purple, which also had, I think, 13 nominations and went home empty-handed. I don't see it doing that, but I don't think it's a clear frontrunner for Best Picture. I think actually 3 Billboards is looking like the likely frontrunner there, although the only wobble there is Martin McDonagh obviously not being up for Best Director.
But it does happen. It does happen.
It does happen. It happened with Argo, for example. So again, there is no, on the traditional Oscar formula, there is no clear definite front runner in the way that we have had some years, but I think in this year it is still up for grabs. And I'm sticking to my I don't know why prediction that it'll be Get Out, and I cannot particularly justify that. But I would
love it to be Get Out for a number of reasons. I do think 3 Billboards is the better film and a more worthy recipient, but it would be awesome to see a comedy horror film win Best Picture. I mean, it's not going to happen, but I would love to see that happen.
It would be kind of cool, though. But I think Frances McDormand, definitely the frontrunner and Best Actress, although that's a very strong category. I think Gary Oldman's the frontrunner for Best Actor, which is weird because Daniel Day-Lewis is right there, but he isn't the frontrunner this time.
But then neither
amazing.
Is Meryl Streep in her category, and that's almost unheard of. So.
Well, no, that's quite heard of because she's been nominated, 21 times now?
For the Meryl Streep Award for being Meryl Streep.
I know, and only won 3 times. So her conversion rate is terrible, whereas Daniel Day-Lewis's is much, much better.
Well. We shall see what happens.
So we shall, yeah. And also, I'm very, very, very happy to see The Breadwinner up for Best Animated Feature because they changed the rules last year and I was worried that it would lock out a lot of those smaller studios from the Best Animated category. Because obviously Cartoon Saloon, who made The Breadwinner, also did The Secret of Kells and The Song of the Sea, which are wonderful and also Oscar nominated. And it's great seeing them continue to get attention this way. And also Loving Vincent, which is the
So when you say change the rules, isn't this due because they're nominated by the Academy as a whole and not just cartoony people?
Not just by animators, yeah. I think it helped having that sort of focus in that category because you did get those slightly older, smaller films and it wasn't just DreamWorks Animation and Pixar having it all their own way. Although, of course, they're still very much in the mix and I think Coco's the front runner there.
Although, let's be honest, of all the categories, that one is a shit show because,
because
we have
one nomination.
The Boss Baby nominated for an Academy Award. Let's say that again, shall we? The Boss Baby nominated for an Academy Award. Also Ferdinand, which was fine. It was the most fine movie, but it's not an Oscar-worthy film.
Yeah, well, but then I actually, the one I'm sort of most... in a way upset about is Victoria and Abdul being nominated for anything because I thought that was the most nothing movie I had ever seen. And it's up for Best Makeup and Hairstyling, which you can absolutely make an argument that was wonderful makeup and hairstyling. But I'm just so underwhelmed by it. Yeah. I'm sorry. I kind of begrudge it, I'm afraid.
Exciting to see The Big Sick make an appearance, though. I love that film.
Yes, really good. So that's Best Original Screenplay, which is very much deserved.
And, of course, The Emergency Plumber getting his nomination for All the Money in the World.
Oh, yes. See what you did there, James.
Well, good. No, sadly, that, not my joke, or indeed Chris's. I think we both recycled it, but nevertheless.
That made me chuckle, actually, that he's actually got an Oscar nomination for that. It's just like, rushed it at the last minute, does it, walks it off. I mean, that's a true pro, right?
Well deserved.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very good in that film.
I was really chuffed to see Logan.
Yeah, fantastic. I was about to say.
That was something that warmed my cockles, even though I actually have a few issues with the story of that film. But it was really good to see it in there. And please, please, please let this be the year that Roger Deakins wins for cinema.
I mean, it has to be, I think. I genuinely don't see, and the thing is, there actually is an argument that Hoyt van Hoytma on Dunkirk did some really innovative and new things, and that he is equally or more deserving.
Amazing heroic things, one
amazing
might even
heroic
say.
Things. But Deakins has done amazing innovative things for years now and keeps losing out, and you know, I just want him to win. Also, by the way, speaking of cinematography, which is a category I get wildly excited about for some reason, Mudbound is the first female cinematographer nominated ever.
Is it now? I didn't know that.
90 years, and whoa, we finally have a female nominee for best cinematography, so that is really fantastic news, and it's about bloody time. So that's even worse than directing. You didn't think it could happen. It has happened.
Are we saying hashtag Oscars so inclusive?
I mean, it's a definite step in the right direction. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
And of course, speaking of awards, there's still a very small amount of time to vote for this year's Empire Awards.
Do it.
Which you can do at empireonline.com/awards2018. Polls close on the 2nd of February, so be sure to vote before then.
Yes, sir.
Other news. Let's have some other news.
So much news.
A complete ton of it. Where do you want to start?
Meryl Streep.
Yes.
We just mentioned her, of course. Huge news as she heads back to TV for Big Little Lies.
Oh my God.
Season 2. Hashtag boss level.
I know.
This is pretty much pretty amazing. I mean, listen, this is a show, if you haven't seen it yet, I'm not going to say anything about it. It's about a crime that takes place in a very she town on the California coast in Big Sur. And it's full of beautiful blonde women, which is why you have, you know, Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Laura Dern, Shailene Woodley, admittedly not blonde, all in there. And they now add Meryl Bloody Streep to proceedings. They also have Andrea Arnold taking some of the directing job in this one, which is pretty amazing. I'm going to say she plays... she plays Alexander Skarsgård's character's mother. I'm not going to say anything more than that, but if you've seen the show, then you'll know why that's important. And that's going to be really juicy. I think that's going to be so juicy.
I literally watched Big Little Lies this week. As in, well, I started it last week, but I finished it this week. And it has been all I've been talking about this week. Because I know why it took me so long to get around to it, but it is so, so good.
It's so good.
And it becomes more and more compelling. And it's funny because they start off, certainly in the first episode, I thought they feel like quite archetypal, very broad characters. Just in, you know, like Reese Witherspoon is like the sort of like very sort of difficult, always in your face mother, you know. But they're so complex, they're so layered, and they're so human.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly believable characters, great cast, amazing performances. If you haven't seen it, definitely watch it.
Definitely.
Because so Meryl's coming to season two.
Meryl's coming.
Epic.
I've seen one episode.
Have you?
Yeah, the
was
first
like,
one.
Oh, well,
I thought,
you started
this
beginning.
Is good. This is good. I should watch some more of this.
But then you had to go back to role playing My Little Pony.
And then and then Tales of Equestria or whatever it's called took my life away.
Well,
in the most sparkly way possible.
Oh. So many sparkles.
Go
yes.
Bronies. Also, something that happened today. Chris
yes.
McQuarrie has announced the title for the sixth Mission Impossible.
Six.
I think there's going to be some fallout over this.
Yes, Mission Impossible Fallout takes place.
Sorry. Mission : Impossible
dash fallout.
All one word.
Yeah, this takes place in an irradiated wasteland that used to be 1960s America. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. But yeah, that's exciting. Mission Impossible Fallout. What do we think? Good?
I think I think there might be a double meaning.
What?
I think it might be something to do with nuclear bombs.
Oh, I thought he
said that.
And
much.
Oh, has
Tom
he?
Tom Cruise falls out of something.
Don't tell me, because I'm working this out for myself.
Oh, okay.
And I think there might be something like maybe like him and Benji have an argument and don't talk to each other for
they
the whole
out.
Film.
Well, if
and,
I can,
and then Benji thinks that Ethan said this about him, and then he thinks Benji said that about him, and then Michelle Monaghan comes in and goes, "Hey guys, what's going on here?" And then they make up just in time to stop the nuclear explosion from going off.
Okay, well, if I may just for a moment quote Chris McQuarrie, who our own Chris talked to earlier today. The title has multiple meanings in the film, from the literal to the figurative. There is the threat of nuclear terrorism hanging over the movie, which is the literal threat. Well done, Dan.
That's what I said.
And the figurative, there's the notion that what happened in the movie is the end result of choices that Ethan Hunt has made in his life. It's Ethan's past come back to haunt him. It's the fallout of all his good intentions.
Is it all those fish he killed in the first one? You know, when the fish tank went boom and all the fish came out.
So you're thinking it's like one of the Jaws sequels with a fish coming back for revenge.
This time it's personal.
It's like Finding Nemo, except crossed with Jaws the Revenge and Mission Impossible.
So it's like Taken meets Finding Nemo.
I hope not.
This time it's Peace in Piscina.
But it's great that Napoleon Solo is part of it as well. I really like what they're doing with the kind of cross-franchise stuff. I think there's going to be like him and Ethan Hunt, Napoleon Solo, James Bond, Jason Bourne. They're all going to get together, and Austin Powers.
I don't really know how to tell you this, Dan, but I don't believe that Henry Cavill is actually playing Napoleon Solo in this film, because of course he has a plot sensitive moustache that he can under no circumstances shave for any reason. So I think, and I don't think Napoleon Solo would have a moustache, so I believe it to be a different character. I hate to burst your bubble.
Well, that just sucks.
Yeah, doesn't it just? But even more exciting perhaps than that, is news that the Doctor of Thuganomics, Mr. John Cena, may be playing Duke Nukem in the Platinum Dunes adaptation of that particular game title. That was a proper double take from me, because, I mean, Duke Nukem is a little bit wrong. It's a little bit bawdy. It's everything toxic about, you know.
Is it like a Night at the President's Club?
It's much like a Night at the President's Club. It's the President's Club dinner, the game.
Okay.
And John Cena, you can't see him, but you will see him in this. Maybe playing him. That's right. Dan's doing the little shaky, wavy face thing. That's mental. I can't imagine why they are doing that. It's also weird because Duke Nukem is heavily ripped off of Ash from Evil Dead. So it's not as if he can use any of his catchphrases.
Maybe it will be one of those kind of ironic things, you know, like when they do like with Baywatch and like they did with the Brady Bunch way back when. They'll do it all ironically, like Duke Nukem exists in this universe where it's all like that. And then he comes into our world and he has to deal with, you know, people being like reasonable and stuff.
The Daily Mail.
Yeah.
Well, that's not people being reasonable, but you know what I mean.
Oh, by the way, when I say our world, I mean the universe that I came from.
Not this particular.
I'm going to try and get back into. I just need to find the right spaceship.
Mushroom Drive.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of irony, there was news of Ryan Reynolds this week. He is apparently involved in a new version of Clue.
Yeah.
Or Cluedo. So this is, obviously, you remember the 1985 film with Tim Curry.
It's based on a board game, Helen.
I know it's based on a board game, Dan. Thank you. But there is a new adaptation planned. Ryan Reynolds is starring and, I think, producing, and he's brought in his Deadpool writers, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick. So that could be a clue as to the sort of tone that we're going to see, which I think could fit quite well, actually.
I hope it cuts the mustard.
Yeah. not if they use the candlestick one of the bludgeons in it.
But that wasn't the weirdest thing, was it? Brian Dundee is all I'm going to say.
Brian Dundee.
Danny McBride is Brian Dundee, the son of Mick Dundee from Crocodile Dundee. This is not a film, surely. Like, we couldn't work out whether this was real or not. Like, it seemed like they've got a crew and stuff, and Chris Hemsworth was there, but it seemed like a joke. This didn't seem like a real film. I'm not convinced it's a real film. I'm going to say that right here and right now. I think it's a gag. I think they're winding us up.
Well, it's not April the 1st.
No, so, but it is an alternate universe, so perhaps it's one in which that film gets made. Are people crying out for a return to Crocodile Dundee?
No, but I think that's maybe why they've made it, in a way. Because, again, it's the irony thing, isn't it?
I think so. But this is also, I mean, it's kind of dropped out of nowhere with no, you know, it has materialised in our midst.
Well, that happens with films, you know.
Yeah,
sometimes.
I suppose there is a point at which they start making them and stop making them and then tell people. Yeah. And we are at that point. So Danny McBride is Brian Dundee. Go nuts.
Yeah.
Is that work out age-wise in terms of when Mick
presumably
and Linda Kozlowski would have had the baby? And then it grows up. Is it going to be Danny McBride's age? I don't think so.
Maybe it predates Linda.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, he seemed like a man of the world, like he'd already lived a little before
That's
then.
That's true.
You know?
Maybe the mother's a croc.
It's possible.
That seems
and actually, so maybe he's a human crocodile hybrid.
I mean, a literal crocodile.
Yeah,
donkey.
Yeah. Maybe we haven't seen the lower half in the pictures. Maybe sort of like from the waist down. He's like got a big scaly tail.
It's a Suicide Squad spin-off, is what you're saying.
Yeah, maybe.
He's killer Crocodile Dundee.
Maybe he's some kind of weird mutant hybrid monster.
Right, well, thanks for that, Dan.
Yeah, that's going to keep me up at night.
See,
also from the 80s, there's a RoboCop sequel being kicked about. This was Ed Neumeier, who wrote RoboCop, is saying that he's working on a sequel to the 1987 original. So he's retconning out RoboCop 2, RoboCop 3, the RoboCop reboot, and everything that's happened since the first one.
Halloween's doing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It,
so. He's pulling a Halloween slash Highlander 3 and picking
And to an extent, actually, the Alien prequels have done the same thing.
Very true.
Superman Returns.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's doing that. Good old Ed. Good.
Good?
I don't know. To me, RoboCop was a one-off. I know it wasn't, but to me it was. It just felt like a perfectly formed one-off, like crazy film, mad, the blend of satire and extreme hyper-violence and everything, and you just like, you watched it and you were like, wow, I'm glad that exists.
Here's a hot fact for you. I once had a classics lecture from RoboCop.
What?
Peter Weller sat there for 25 minutes and talked to me about Grecian architecture and Roman history.
Cool.
I was on the set of Sons of Anarchy, and he was on it playing a corrupt cop. But he apparently he lectures in classics, and so he stood up and genuinely did a classics lecture.
Amazing.
In between takes.
What did you learn?
I honestly, all of it just kind of went in one ear and out the other, because I was looking at thinking it's RoboCop. You know, he said, you know, Grecian urns are nice, and I heard, dead or alive, you're coming with me. It was awesome.
Did he finish by telling you to stay out of trouble?
He did. Ah. He did, indeed.
Did you know the Romans had slot machines and automatic doors?
Slot machines?
Yep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You've made that up.
I did not. It's in Tom Holland's book, Rubicon. Not that
okay.
Tom Holland.
First of all.
Nor the other Tom Holland.
You don't want to believe anything Spider-Man tells you.
Okay, not that Tom Holland.
She did say not that Tom Holland.
Yeah, but she might have meant not that Tom, not Tom Holland, meaning my roofer Tom Holland.
No, but I also said not that Tom Holland, not that Tom Holland, or that Tom Holland,
or
that Tom Holland.
Okay, fine.
Or Tom Holland.
So it was that Tom Holland.
It was that
right.
Tom Holland.
Right.
Lovely guy.
Fantastic.
I interviewed him, actually.
I know you did. I remember, I was quite jealous.
He's quite funny. Mm.
Did you know, Holland isn't a country?
Is it a duchy?
I really hope I'm not wrong about this. I'm pretty sure it's a province of the Netherlands.
Okay, cool.
Like the Netherlands is a country and Holland is a part of it, and they're not interchangeable, so you can't actually say Holland when you mean the Netherlands.
I knew we were supposed to say the Netherlands, at least.
Okay. So that's a hot thing.
All right, so and we pass the duchy then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. On the left-hand side, I'm saying. Anywho.
Shall we have another guest?
Wait. Before we do, there are two quick things I'm going to cover. So Peter Jackson is coming back and doing something which isn't Mortal Engines, which he's been producing. He is doing a World War I documentary where he is hand-colorizing footage. So that's exciting.
Cool.
That will come at some point.
That's gonna be awesome.
Black Dynamite is getting a sequel. I've not seen Black Dynamite, so I don't care. Cloverfield / The God Particle is going straight to Netflix. That's quite interesting.
That is unusual, yeah.
Yeah, in the wake of, obviously, Annihilation is now going for international distribution, is going straight to Netflix. And obviously, Mute was made for Netflix, and Bright, 100 million film made for Netflix. They are all over the shop
they are,
at
yeah,
the moment.
Absolutely. I'm disappointed. I'd like to see Annihilation on the big screen, because I was reading the book over Christmas, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I'd love to see it on the big screen. But then maybe they will screen it. Who knows?
Just sit closer to the telly.
Yeah, you're so right. Thanks, Dan.
But I know Alex Garland wasn't thrilled about that, and I kind of understand why, but Cloverfield will be third Cloverfield, I should say, will be going straight to Netflix.
Cool.
Are they all in the same world? Are they
the Cloverfields?
Yeah. Or are they just not? Is it just like,
I mean, they are kind of, aren't they? Or are they? I don't know, because they were aliens, but then do aliens equate to a giant monster? I mean, who knows?
Speaking of aliens for a minute, can I just recommend something for a second? I've been reading a Chinese sci-fi series. The first book is called The Three-Body Problem.
Okay.
It's by, I can't pronounce the name, Shizhen Lu, I believe. But it is absolutely wonderful. The first book was on Obama's reading list, and I looked into it and saw Chinese sci-fi, and I thought, well, I don't know anything about that. That would be fascinating. It's incredible. Mm. It's absolutely incredible. I've read the first two. I'm still in the third. Unbelievable stuff. Get after it. It's so good.
The Three-Body Problem.
The Three-Body Problem.
I'm writing that.
Hot tip for everyone.
Yeah, it's proper like hard sci-fi. This is not space opera. This is not kind of fancy dressed up as sci-fi, but it is superb stuff.
Excellent.
Finally, before we move on. There is other news this week. There is a new issue of Empire.
Hurrah!
Landing on your doormat. The March issue of the magazine, which hits shelves this week, and is even now available from all Evil and Evil newsagents. We do not have good ones in this universe. This month, and entirely appropriately, we celebrate all things wicked and wanton with a literary party for cinema's greatest villains. We polled, you voted, and we have assembled a fitting tribute to movie's biggest bads. It's not just a list either. We've got you, Helen,
yes,
going head-to-head with the ghost of Chris Hewitt.
Yes, and winning. Yes.
And winning to argue Kylo Ren versus Darth Vader. We've got odes to Loki, the Joker, Gollum.
Dan did the Joker, didn't
you? Dan did the Joker.
I talked to Andy Serkis about his favourite Gollum moments.
Amazing.
Although he was a bit confused because he doesn't see Gollum as a villain.
Quite right.
An anti-hero, is he saying?
No, he's a victim.
He's a victim.
He's a victim.
Victim of the ring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No victim blaming here. The T-1000, he was a cracking new interview and photo shoot.
That was all great. I was just reading that this morning.
It's good, isn't it? With the silver in the arm and the stuff. Good. Look at that. Plus a genuinely good piece by Nick where he talks to Die Hard. That sounded really faint. A genuinely good piece from Nick.
A surprisingly competent piece of writing.
Let's try that again. Plus a genuinely brilliant piece of writing from the superlatively talented Nick DeSemlin, who talks to Die Hard screenwriter and anecdote machine Steve D'Souza about Hans Gruber. Which is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's not all. There are features on Pacific Rim Uprising, Daniel Day-Lewis, Duncan Jones' Mute. There's a big interview with Paddy Considine on his upcoming Journeyman, which I urge you all to see.
Yeah, really good.
Plus glimpses of Soldado, Jessica Jones Season 2, The New Mutants, which frankly this is the first you're going to see of that for a while, or the last you'll see of it for a while, and much more. There's also an epic viewing guide for Kingsman The Golden Circle and a chat.
There'll be the old mutants by the time the film comes out, won't they?
Ye gods. And a chat with Denis Villeneuve about Blade Runner 2049, which happily segues nicely into my next bit of housekeeping, which is the long awaited spoiler special for Blade Runner 2049. Will not, in fact, be coming out in 2049, but we'll be here on Monday, and that's pretty exciting. So do make sure you download it. We would release it now, but haven't done it.
No, we need...
We're doing it, in fact,
in 15 minutes time. Yeah.
Well, you two and John are doing it, I'm not, but yes. So look forward to that.
Hurrah.
And that is news. Right, since you're both boring me, it's time for another guest. And for our second interview of this week's pod, John Nugent, for it is he, pits his wits against the Archbishop of Animation, the Master of Moulding, the Consigliere of Clay. I'm not going to carry on with this.
Prince of Plasticine? Yeah, come good. On.
He is, of course, the original odd man, Mr. Nick Park. He and first man voice Tom Hiddleston made themselves available for John's rabid interrogation, which you can hear now.
We are delighted to have on the Empire podcast Nick Park and Tom Hiddleston. How are you both?
Very well.
Oh, yeah, very well. Yeah. Yes, we are very well, thank you.
You speak collectively.
We do. We speak for each other somehow.
I had a horrible cold last week, but it's all over now.
So glad to hear it.
A bit nasally, but... Yeah.
So, Early Man, we're here to talk about, obviously. Right from the start, it reminded me of those old, like, Ray Harryhausen B-movies with the dinosaurs fighting. Are those the sort of films you watched as kids, both of you?
Honestly, not so much. But I used to watch Aardman films as a child.
Well, there you go,
So maybe that's a question for Nick. But Aardman, I mean, I can't remember when I first saw A Grand Day Out or The Wrong Trousers. But that's the stuff I used to watch anyway.
Oh, well, that's flattering. Yeah. Thanks.
You knew that.
I very much Ray Harryhausen was a hero of mine. And I saw A Million Years BC when I was about 11. I think I was too young to notice Raquel Welsh. I was obsessed with dinosaurs. That actually is the film that made me pick up my parents' home movie camera and want to make films.
Oh, wow.
And I started as a hobby, you know, just making animated films and building dinosaurs and stuff. And I was rooting through old films the other day and discovered, I hadn't quite realised it, but one of my first animated films, I was 14 or something, 13, was about a caveman and a dinosaur. It was
really?
Called Murphy and Bongo. And I shot the whole thing in about a week.
Is Bongo the dinosaur?
The dinosaur, yeah, Brontosaurus, a sort of pink Brontosaurus, made of plasticine. And Murphy is like this caveman with a big nose and pipe cleaner legs, you know, very 70s looking. And it's a little adventure they went on. But I shot the whole thing, and the whole thing was out of focus. You know, in those days, he came back from Kodak like 2 weeks later, and I discovered the whole thing was out of focus.
Oh, no.
I'm thinking, is there a digital way to sort of sharpen it up and improve
yeah, maybe.
It?
So Murphy and Bongo is in some ways a prequel to Early Man, then?
Yeah, I think it's always been in my sort of DNA to do a caveman movie. It seemed a great But you're always thinking, well, it's not good enough just to be another caveman adventure. What's the kind of Aardman or, you know, quirky angle on it? And it was that, oh, what about if cavemen invented football, you know? And that's when it all began to have legs.
And Tom, it's fair to say we've never seen you play a character like this before. I mean, he's a short, fat Frenchman. How did you embody the role of a short, fat Frenchman?
Well, it was, I don't know, really. I remember being sent the script, and it just made me laugh so much. And I'd seen a sketch of him, and he was, you know, his chest was like a kind of trapezium that was wider as the further south you travel from the neck. He had very thin arms and small hands and this bald head. And the sketch made me laugh and the script made me laugh. And then I met Nick and he said, you know, I'm thinking of doing want the Bronze Age, because they're a bit more advanced. Want the Bronze Age to sound maybe European, because Europeans are better at football. And then it was about just trying to be as pompous and puffed up. And if Nick laughed, then we were sort of doing okay. Perhaps I found my true self, I don't know.
I know it was quite a, in a way it was exciting being able to go to Tom, because I saw Tom on the Graham Norton show doing impressions.
And, oh yes,
Tom's a mate, he can do anyone.
Yeah,
I don't know if we can get him to do any.
It's something I don't know why I do. From about the age you were at when you made your Murphy and Bongo film, I had a double tape deck cassette player, and there's a somewhere in a box in an attic somewhere is my own radio show where I do all the voices. And I interview people and I do the weather, and it's mad, I suppose. I mean, 36 now, but once upon a time I was a child. I just was always interested in the way people speak and how they speak differently. So I've always been interested in different sounds, and that's where the impressions evolved from.
This character, is there a touch of hello hello in the accent?
What do you think? It was more like, sometimes I remember Nick saying when we were in the sessions, I said, you know, do you want it to be a true French pronunciation or an English pronunciation with a French accent? So it might be a word like imagination in French is imagination.
Yeah.
But it's sort of funnier if it's imagination. So it's still got the English rhythm,
right, yes,
with a bit of bad French on top of it. I feel like, you know, as a Francophile, this is you know, this isn't a true French accent, is it? It's a sort of silly, pompous French accent that we've invented specially for Lord Knuth.
Because
he is the most self-important, puffed up, egomaniacal figure, and he loves bronze, and he sort of wants to collect everyone's bronze. That's his only relationship, really, is with bronze. And so it was I remember every time we did a take of any line in any scene, it was about trying to find his lack of self-awareness and his pomposity. And so he just sounds, I mean, he is an idiot. It's just to sound stupid.
I know as I'm working with Mark Burton on the script, we were often, you know, thinking, where do we pitch him exactly? And what do we go to you with? And how much of a villain is he? You know, how dark do we go? And I think we did come back to you, I think, didn't we, with a slightly different... a different idea at one point, which was the less villainous, in a less dark or more of a middle manager.
Yes.
He was just a climber, social climber, yeah. or avaricious.
Yeah.
And he became a bit simpler.
Yeah, just frustrated with his position in the world and wanting to have a higher status. But I think mostly it was his lack of self-awareness as well, to have this sense, this elevated sense of superiority.
Yes.
But also, you know, it also sort of, without realizing the impact he's making on people.
Yes.
The people are sniggering at him or laughing at him.
Yes. And I guess that the difference is, I guess in plays or in live action films, you have rehearsal time, and it's often you've got the script the day before.
Yes.
And we use that time, we get together in the recording booth, and that's where we have this exploratory time, and it's great, you know, with someone with the skill that Tom has, just to explore and try all sorts of stuff out.
Thanks, Nick.
It's a pleasure for me.
I loved coming in and figuring it out, and because also when you do a perform, I mean, I was new to this in lots of ways. I've done one animated voice before, but nothing quite on this scale. And we, Nick and I, are sitting in quite a small sound studio in central London, you know, with all the equipment, and there's no footage of the film particularly that we're matching to, because they then animate after they get the recordings. And of course this is set in these great wide open spaces in the sort of some prehistoric era, or there are scenes set in stadia, you know, big football stadiums, and so your voice has to carry on and represent the atmosphere of those places. So sometimes it feels like it's too big, but Nick is such a brilliant specific guide about, because he can see what it's going to be. So he says, no, you're in the middle of a football stadium, and you have to, you know, you're chanting and screaming and there's crowd noise, and so, you know, we're in this tiny room in central London, but I'm pretending I'm in this prehistoric football stadium.
Yeah, I always think it must be hard because you've got no costume, you've got no set to it, you know, you've got no environment, so it's all got to come from in here, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And Nick, you voice a character in this film as well. You voice Hognog.
Oh yeah,
the warthog dog sort of character.
Yes.
Did you get any acting tips from Tom on that?
I was learning all the time.
Well, you did actually. Yeah. You did do the only piece of kind of vocal motion capture.
Oh.
When, as, because there's the scene in the film where Lord Nuth is having a bath and he gets a massage from Hognob.
That's right. Yes.
And in when we recorded that scene,
yes,
I got a massage from Nick Park.
I got to massage Tom Huddleston.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
I know, it was the most surreal moment.
Very, very, very.
And you were doing the voice.
Well, I was as well. I mean, I got the part by accident because you know, when we're editing the whole thing on storyboards and putting it into the Avid editing machine, we do scratch voices ourselves at the studio just to see how the story's working. And I was going to cast somebody as Hognob, and but the crew just said, "Oh, we love it the way you do it." So I got the part. But then, like Tom says, there was that scene where Hognob is stuck and he's mistaken for Lord Nuth Masseur, and he has to go ahead and massage him without, obviously he doesn't know it's a pig. But, Tom was trying to get the sound, you know, that, you know, that warble in the voice when you're having your shoulders, you know, chopsticks on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And it was good, but I think I just said, why don't I step in as Hognob?
Let's go method.
And I suddenly thought, what am I doing? I'm massaging Tom Hiddleston.
in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
How many would pay good money for this?
Did you feel loosened up, Tom?
I did. It was really nice. I thought, it's working for a living.
It really worked, though. Yeah. I mean, that is the tape we used, was that... It's really funny the way, you know, Tom's voice, the way you warble.
You know, you're trying to get that sort of effect. You can't really reproduce it on your own.
Yeah.
So... You get Oscar winner Nick Park to do it for you.
Masseur to the stars.
Absolutely.
That's funny.
Tom, I'm going to have to ask, I'm almost out of time, but I'm contracted to ask about Marvel. And obviously, you know, you won't be able to tell me anything. I guess I wanted to ask your reaction to the Infinity War trailer.
It looks very impressive, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's very exciting. And I found it quite... This is an odd thing to say, but I found it quite touching because I remember when I was cast as Loki for the very first time, almost 10 years ago, and Kevin Feige, the president of Marvel Studios, called me into his office to say congratulations. And then one of the first things he said was, let me talk to you about Avengers. And I thought I'd just been cast in Thor.
Right.
And he's told me the dream he had to build this fleet of films, this Marvel Cinematic Universe that was culminating in Avengers. And suddenly the Marvel Cinematic Universe has expanded to such an extraordinary size that it can encompass and encapsulate so many different characters who people have taken to their hearts and followed and loved, whether it's all the people from the Captain America films or the Guardians of the Galaxy, or you know, it's become so peopled now. Yeah. And I was it's just so impressive, and I say that almost outside it.
Yeah.
And I feel so lucky to be a part of it. So that's why I found it exciting.
Yeah. Nick, would you ever go into superheroes? Do you think stop motion superheroes could be a thing one day?
Well, I think the guys doing it are so good at it. I feel maybe it doesn't lend itself to plasticine. I don't think.
Yeah, fair enough. I think
maybe we would if it was in an Aardman kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A British superhero.
Why not?
Yeah. I think I'm out of time though, but okay. Thank you so much for your time, Tom and Nick. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nick Park and Tom Hiddleston there. As we make a sprint for this week's finish line, it's time for reviews. First up this week, we have Downsizing. Alexander Payne's film in which population problems lead to a miniaturization of people in an endeavor to save space. What did we think of this one? John!
Oh, I really liked it, actually. I think it's a kind of a new area for Alexander Payne. It's sort of gone into sort of sci-fi satire territory. And it starts off, I actually found it quite genuinely creepy with the way it sort of shows how this new technology, which, by the way, makes no scientific sense. So let's just get that out of the way, okay? It makes no scientific sense, and there are massive problems surrounding the whole concept that if you start going there, you'll just ruin the film for yourself. So don't go there. Like, for example, why aren't they being killed by ants? Why don't water droplets just destroy them? But you put that stuff aside and just look at the idea, which is that when people get shrunk down to about whatever it is, 6 inches, they become more economically and ecologically viable. And so it's a way of making the human race sustainable on Earth. But the way it gets commercialized and the process that you go through to become small is, you know, it's actually quite creepy and odd. And that's when the film's like being properly sci-fi during that. Then once you come out the other side of it and Matt Damon has, you know, gone through with the process, then it kind of becomes a different kind. I think this might have rubbed some people up the wrong way, but it becomes this, it's more about a satire on haves and have-nots, and also there's a dystopian thing going on in the background, which I don't want to go too much into because it's a bit of a spoiler. And then it's a romantic comedy as well. I mean, there's a rom-com element to it, which again has a sort of aspect to it, which I know has rubbed some people up the wrong way. Hong Chau's character has been seen as being quite caricatured. Mm. But personally, after the initial like, they're really doing this, and I thought, and you sort of find out more about her, and the relationship builds between her and Damon's character, I actually found it really lovable and affecting. And by the end of the film, it felt like the kind of, you know, the most heartwarming and light dark dystopian drama I'd ever seen.
That's not unfair, I think. I liked it as well, but I had a few more caveats. This is probably another sort of Molly's Game thing where I'd give it probably 3 stars-ish more than 4. But my biggest thing with it was that actually there's too much of a good thing going on here. There are too many ideas being thrown at us and not enough time devoted to many of them. This feels like at least a 10-hour series, if not multiple seasons of a TV show. You know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, Michael Schur from The Good Place would do brilliantly, but he'd do it over 3 or 4 seasons.
Yeah.
And I love Alexander Payne generally, and I think his take on things and his approach to things is really good, but it just felt like there was just too much stuffed into this for me to kind of feel any of it and get to grips with any of it and really think about the consequences of any of it. Because yes, you know, they live under a dome for the most part, so that keeps the ants out, but there are bits where they're outside and you're right, there's none of that kind of dealt with. They've missed a trick there, that they don't have somebody fighting a butterfly or something. You know, come on, give the people what they want.
Or imagine, like, you know, just whatever, a fox,
anything.
A badger.
Yeah.
your concern being that it wasn't Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Well, I mean, a little bit that, but more, there are all these fascinating big ideas in this film, and they, again, I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but it's not just the ecological thing, but a whole stuff about what makes us human and everything else, and it doesn't do anything or enough with them all. And you're right, there has been criticism of Hong Chau's character, which I think is mostly unfair, but there's also been a lot of criticism of Matt Damon's role as a sort of white savior, which I think is mostly fair. So it just kind of does go off the rails a little bit, but it feels like at least 3 films stuck together, and the first one is brilliant and the second and third ones are less so.
Okay. Worth seeing probably so you can tell your friends you saw an Alexander Payne science fiction film.
I think so. Okay. I think you should always go see an Alexander Payne film, personally.
Mm. Okay. Are we calling this the 4-star masterpiece that is downsizing?
I think we are.
But we actually gave it 4 stars. Okay, good. Next up, we have Maze Runner The Death Cure, which is the final installment in the Maze Runner trilogy, based on the young adult books, in which they presumably cure death. Helen.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into spoilers again about whether or not they cure death, James. So this film starts off at a run and never really slows down, which I think is to its credit. There is no title card, no narration reminding you who's who, what's what, and what's going on. So you will have to just try and pick it up as you go, because I'll be honest, I'd forgotten since the last one. But I did remember it all. And they've taken the very wise decision of slightly streamlining the books, because I thought the first book was a pretty cool premise that went a little bit off the rails, and the sequels went massively off the rails and across the desert. So this one actually sort of, by dint of ignoring a lot of that, just stays quite focused and quite action-y. And the basic idea is that Thomas, who's Dylan O'Brien's character, and his friends have been experimented on. That's the maze they were in the first film. They have then crossed the desert. They've found allies. They've found some kind of refuge. But their friend Mino was recaptured by the evil organization Wicked, literally called Wicked.
Wicked is good.
Wicked is good. That's led by Patricia Clarkson's scientist and Aidan Gillen's evil head of security. And so they go off to rescue Mino and have to break into this heavily guarded city, make their ways to Wicked headquarters, break him out, and it goes on from there. So it is essentially a get in, get out with the guy kind of a movie. What it has going for it is it cannot have had that big a budget, but every single penny is up there on the screen. Like, it looks great. The action is good. It keeps the pace moving, so you don't really care about the things that maybe don't work as well. Mm. I think all the young actors are good. You've got, you know, Thomas Brody Sangster in there as well, Kaya Scodelario, really, really good people. So it kind of keeps up the pace, but, you know, it doesn't make any sense, let's be honest.
See, I haven't seen this one yet. I have seen both The Maze Runner and The Scorch Trials.
Yeah.
And I always thought the problem with this is, like, Hunger Games knew what it was about, in that it was about the Hunger Games. Hunger Games really weren't that. Yeah. So in the second one, you have a second Hunger Games, and in the third one, you have a pseudo-Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So they just keep repeating the same formula. And I thought the maze was a really cool idea in this, but then the second film was just drivel, because it was them running around a wasteland and not really doing very much, and you lost that the tightness of that core premise. So it's interesting to hear that they kind of maybe have brought it back in a bit.
Well, they haven't, though. That's the thing. It's a really weird franchise because the thing that sets it up kind of just gets left behind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it gets less interesting the further it gets away from its original premise. So, and it's also kind of like in the first one, you had, you know, the Grievers, which were these cool robot spider monsters.
Yeah.
And the second one, what new monster is there? And it's raging zombies. Mm. Okay. I've seen that before. You know, it was just kind of I Am Legend crossed with Mad Max. And then in the third one, it's like, okay, what are you going to do? Oh, no, it's just people.
Yeah.
Bad people. And zombies. They're in it, but they're not, you know, the kind of, you know, there's a bit with a griever, isn't there? And then there's a bit with a zombie or the zombies. Yeah. But, and then it just becomes people having a bit of a fight.
When I say it's stripped back, you're right. It's not stripped back the whole way to the maze, but it is stripped back compared to what happened in the book, which is so freaking bananas. I can't even, like, there's this whole kind of psychic thing going on. Like, it just goes to some mental places, which I didn't particularly like. Okay. So it's stripped back in that respect, but perhaps not quite as... it's no Mad Max Fury Road in terms of being stripped to the bone.
No, but to be fair, though, I'm quite fond of this, you know, as a YA franchise. I think it's perfectly fun, and I think if you're like, you know, 12... then it would feel quite original and exciting to you. But, you know, I'm old and boring and I've seen dozens of films that this is basically just another version of.
Yeah. So we gave it 3 stars. So it's good for what it is.
We gave it 3 stars, but really this boils down to if you've seen the first two, you should probably watch it. And if you haven't, don't start now. Yeah.
That's not unfair.
Okay. Yeah. Next up, Last Flag Flying. This is Richard Linklater's latest. Starring Bryan Cranston, Lawrence Fishburne, Steve Carell in a bittersweet road trip movie centered around dead soldiers.
Yeah, so these guys all serve together in Vietnam is the idea, and they are going to retrieve the body of Steve Carell's character's son, who has been now killed in Iraq. And it is, bittersweet is the word, because it is, you know, grief-stricken. It is absolutely... you know, Carell's character is absolutely sort of almost verging on unable to function, but he goes to get his old army buddies to kind of help him do this and help him go through this. And it turns out they have history. And you know, they have their own issues that they're kind of bringing to it. So Lawrence Fishburne's character is now a preacher and doesn't really want to be away from his people and his, you know, his parish. And you have Bryan Cranston's character who's still trying to live it up like he's 21, you know. So it's an interesting little threesome. Carell is dialed right back to the bone. But their interactions and their dynamic, I thought, was really, really good, and that's what keeps you going. That's what keeps you interested. And of course, they're all brilliant, so that, you know, helps.
They are. It's hard to argue with the cast.
It really is very, very difficult to argue with this cast. And it is that they're basically trying to deal with a bureaucratic situation of death. You know, they're in this military bureaucracy dealing with, you know, the worst grief a parent can face. It's kind of an interesting and awful setup for a story.
So that's feel-good comedy romp, Last Flag Flying.
It is. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not unrelentingly miserable, but it is somber. But there's heart to it. So I don't want to give the impression that it's a total downer. It is a downer in many ways, but it's the friendship and the mutual support and the love that they have for each other, and even, you know, for the dead boy that kind of keeps you going.
Okay.
So it's not Breaking Bad meets The Matrix meets Anchorman, then?
It is 100% not that at all.
Did the soldier get killed with the trident?
Oh, good Lord.
That escalated fast.
Yeah, it did. 4 stars for Last Flag Flying. Early Man up next. This is a claymation extravaganza from Aardman, which sees a Bronze Age Everton taking on a Paleolithic Liverpool in a clash of the Titans as the Reds and the Blues face off in the final of the Football I don't know what it's about.
I mean, that's not...
It's about plasticine.
Untrue. This is an odd Aardman effort. So it is about the Stone Age. And the idea is that since ancient times, these Stone Age tribes have been playing football. And there's this one isolated little valley, like completely cut off from everything, where they actually don't play football anymore. But outside in the rest of the world, it's going well. And when the outside world invades their valley and takes it over and decides to turn it into a mine and they are rejected, they end up with the chance to win their valley back by playing football. So they have to learn how to work as a team and play football in order to win back their homeland. And I mean, there's probably lots and lots of football jokes in it that I didn't get. I did get some of them, I'm pretty sure. But that's the essential thrust of the plot. It's, you know, play football to win your homeland, which I guess is as good a reason as any other to have a homeland. I mean, it's probably better than just killing loads of people. Tom Hiddleston plays the bad guy for once, not our hero. The honour goes to Eddie Redmayne. But it is a good voice cast. You've got Maisie Williams and people in there as well. It's, for me, not top class Aardman, I have to say. I didn't think there were quite enough jokes.
You're saying it's a bit offside?
I probably am. I actually do know the offside rule, but yeah, sure. That seems roughly.
Can I just point out I made a football joke and I don't believe I got enough credit for that.
It wasn't actually.
It's literally the only thing I know about football, that there is an offside rule. And I had this explained to me once with a diagram. It's all about when the ball is played.
I understand offside as well.
How do you understand offside?
Well, because I wondered what the hell it was, so I looked it up.
Fair enough.
It didn't really work, did it, James?
No, not really. Should we both be substituted?
Yeah.
And send yellow card, yeah. red card.
Red is when you go off. Yellow's when you get a warning.
Yes.
Yeah.
And nil-nil draw on something.
Back on the bench.
Third division out.
With us.
This is amazing, guys.
Wickets. Anyway, right.
From the sounds of it, I'm slightly funnier than early man, Sir.
I mean, you're not a million miles off. But yeah, we gave it 3 stars because obviously I've missed half the jokes and there were more in there than I thought.
We gave it 3 stars. And that is it. Apart from 12 Strong, the film formerly known as Horse Soldiers, which we also gave 3 stars to and is not about horse people.
Did they change the title? Because if you say Horse Soldiers really quickly, it sounds like you're saying something else.
Yes, Dan. That's actually the reason they gave. Yes. And that is it from the Evil Empire podcast. We'll be returning to our regular reality next week for an altogether less sinister episode. We'll also be coming to you live from the King's Place on 14th of February for our 300th episode, which is very exciting, and for which a few precious tickets may just still be available. In the meantime, though, it's a throaty mwahaha and threatening death stare from Helen. A creepy leer from Dan. And a simple threat of ruin and world domination from me. Until next time, people.